And while we're getting set, our next case is going to be case number 53264, Franchise Tax Board versus Hyatt. Looks like you have Ms. Lundell and Mr. Hutchison. Ms. Lundell, we have Mr. Eisenberg and Ms. Leonard. And with Mr. Hutchison, we have Mr. Wall. Will anybody be speaking besides Ms. Lundell and Mr. Hutchison?
No, Your Honor.
Just the two of you? Okay.
Just the two of us, Your Honor.
Ms. Lundell, we're ready for you to begin.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Pat Lundell from McDonald Corona, speaking here on behalf of State of California's Franchise Tax Board. We're here this morning because the U.S. Supreme Court vacated your 2014 decision, and it gave instructions upon remand for you to conduct further proceedings that were consistent with and in conformity with its decision. Now, what I find interesting is the U.S. Supreme Court's decision is in practical effect the same as what this court issued in its 2002 decision in this case. Your 2002 decision, while citing comedy as the reason, held that the FTB was to be afforded the same immunities as a Nevada agency would in Nevada courts. In other words, that California's agency was to be treated the same as a Nevada state agency. And we briefed this case since the remand then in 2003 based upon that legal principle. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court's 2016 decision elevated your reasoning to that of a constitutional mandate. It held that the full faith and credit clause, not simply comedy, but the full faith and credit clause mandated that equal treatment. The 2016 decision states that you, as a Nevada court, cannot discriminate against the state of California as a sister state. Now, how do you determine, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, discrimination? Is when you demonstrate hostility to a sister state. The U.S. Supreme Court also answered the question as to when you see hostility or when you demonstrate hostility. And hostility is demonstrated, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, when you disregard your own ordinary legal principles applicable to your own state agencies. Look at the cases that were cited by the U.S. Supreme Court for this proposition. There were two, the Broderick versus Bosner decision and Hughes versus Fetter. Both of those cases stand for the basic proposition that you may not show hostility, and hostility is shown by abandoning and disregarding ordinary legal principles. And to underscore this point, let me quote directly from the opinion, the 2016 opinion itself. Nevada has not applied the principles of Nevada law ordinarily applicable to suits against Nevada's own agencies. So in addition to the issue of damages, allow me to demonstrate how your 2014 decision abandoned ordinary legal principles and treated the FTB differently than it would have done to a sister state agency. To begin, let me focus then on the fraud claim. This court has never allowed a collateral attack to be launched against our own Nevada tax agency. It's been recognized as far back as 1876 that, in fact, that we will not permit collateral attacks against our own state agency. And the reason for that, the court stated, is such collateral attacks derange the operations of government and they thereby cause serious harm to the public. Now, this court has used three basic doctrines to protect against collateral attack against our state agencies: exhaustion of administrative remedies, deference to the fact-finding and legal conclusions by our taxing agencies, and full immunity under statutes like NRS 372.670. And if those three doctrines have not been applied by the lower courts, you have seen fit to dismiss those claims. As this court's precedents show, protecting our own state's sovereign issue of tax collection protects the public, but at the same time then gives procedures and protections to individuals who think that the taxing agency has made the wrong decision. Now, turning your attention in specifically to this court's decision in 2014, you recognized that Mr. Huff was launching a collateral attack through his fraud claim against the fact-finding and the legal conclusions that were found by the FTB. You called him out on his pervasive challenge that the fact-finding and legal conclusions had not been made fairly and impartially. At page 57 of your 24 decision, you pointed out that his arguments put the jury in the position of first finding that the FTB and to analyze whether or not the FTB had made the right decision. This court stated that that precise argument exceeded the jurisdictional boundaries of this case. You went on to say that the bulk of the evidence that he had offered at the time of trial in support of his fraud claim was inadmissible and never should have been presented to the jury. You listed his allegation of a $24 million error, testimony about cooperation and intimidation, the only relevance of which was to the imposition of tax penalties by the FTB. That included testimony from Malcolm Jumelet, from Paul Shurbich, from Ed Antolin, from Mike Kern, from Eugene Cowan. You also said that allegations of trumped-up charges to extort a settlement never should have been admitted. Questions concerning whether or not one auditor gave undue credibility to the affidavit of estranged family members. And in addition, even if the auditor found relevant, evidence to be adverse to Mr. Hyatt's position. That was your laundry list. Your laundry list was quite long. And you said that that evidence never should have been admitted at the time of trial. You went on to say that the jury instruction that was given that expressly invited the jury to second guess the decisions that had been made by the FTB, the fact finding and the legal conclusions. You stated that that jury instruction never should have been given. When you analyze the argument, the closing argument that was given at the time of trial, as to the fraud claim in particular, that argument echoed all of the evidence that in fact that you held was inadmissible. They coupled that then with the argument on the jury instruction that never should have been given. And they stated to the jury, this is what we have been talking about this entire case. Yet inexplicably, within the context of the fraud claim, you found all of that error to be harmless. In reaching that conclusion, you never evaluated this within the context of the three protections that are normally afforded to our own state agencies. You did not even evaluate the claim within the context of the clear and convincing standard that is applicable to all fraud claims. For example, given his collateral attack and given his theory of the case on his fraud claim in particular, which challenged the FTB's fact-finding and their legal conclusions, you should have required Mr. Hyatt to first exhaust his administrative remedies. As the court well knows, those administrative procedures are still ongoing in the state of California. You should have required him to dismiss, at the minimum, his fraud claim until resolution of those administrative processes that are ongoing in the state of California. On the very day that you issued your 2014 decision in this case, you also issued Deja Vu Showgirls. That underscored the importance of the exhaustion of administrative remedies. In that case, you pointed out the importance of the exhaustion of administrative remedies within the context of fact-finding and legal conclusions that were to be done by the state agency that was at issue. Yet in our case, you did not require exhaustion. You did not dismiss until exhaustion had occurred. Even in the Feline case, you expressly recognized the importance of the exhaustion of administrative remedies. In that case, the injured employee had filed their claim and had won at every administrative level their entitlement to workers' comp benefits. But what did the employer do? They thumbed their nose at all of those findings. And they refused to pay. They didn't bring a petition for judicial review. They simply thumbed their nose and didn't pay. They completely transcribed the authority that had been given to them. In that circumstance, it's no wonder that the court found the claim.
But Slumball, I understand your argument that we, as to what we should have done with respect to administrative remedies, but it seems like your argument, like the majority's statement in the Supreme Court opinion, overlooked what we said in our opinion in 2014, that we would not extend to a Nevada government agency the immunity under 41032 to intentional torts and bad faith conduct.
Justice Hardesty, you then have to look past the label that has been placed upon this by Mr. Hyatt, and you have to look at what they actually did behind that label. And as an example, you, in the 2014 decision, found as the predicate for his fraud claim to be statements that were issued by the FTB in compliance with the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. Nevada has a Taxpayer Bill of Rights itself, and it is a directive that is required by the legislature that our own state passing agencies are required to give. But never before have we recognized a fraud claim against our own agencies, let alone a fraud claim based upon a directive that is required by the legislature to be given, let alone based upon a common law fraud claim, when in fact that there believes to be an allegation in violation of the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, without ever analyzing whether or not that the legislature intended a private right of action in those circumstances. Our Taxpayer Bill of Rights includes rights such as an taxpayer is entitled to a prompt response to their inquiries to the department. Are we really going to allow a common law fraud claim when a taxpayer doesn't believe that it got a prompt response to its inquiries, or when in fact that it thought that it had to give more evidence to our own state taxing agency when it thought that it was necessary for them to do their job? Those are the types of rights that are found in our own Taxpayer Bill of Rights. And those are the types of claims that this court would recognize then by upholding the fraud claim upon that particular predicate. And so to the extent that what I believe that the court needs to analyze is that every decision that you republish as a result of this court coming, this case coming back then for your review, that our own state has to recognize is going to be applicable to our own taxing agencies. And very quickly then, what I'm going to do then is to turn to Feline. Feline, you upheld as still good law. We had argued before you that in fact that we thought that that case had been overruled. But you disagreed and you said Feline was still good law. Feline had two holdings applicable to government agencies. The second holding dealt with the intentional infliction claim. And in Feline, the court said that the intentional infliction claim would be dismissed as a matter of law. Why? Because that factual circumstance may also bring forth punitive damages. And in reading that decision, it's clear that the immunity from intentional infliction claims is derivative, then, of the immunity from punitive damages. And so if Feline is going to be good law, and there's a negative in Feline, then we should get the benefit of the positive in Feline. And we would urge the court, then, to embrace both aspects of it. If you're going to embrace Feline, to embrace both aspects and to dismiss not only the fraud claim, but also the intentional infliction claim. With the balance of my time, I'd like to reserve.
Mr. Hutchison for Mr. Hyatt.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Mark Hutchison, and it's been my honor for about the past 20 years to represent Respondent Gil Hyatt since we filed the lawsuit in 1998. He's here with us in the courtroom, and it's my honor to represent him here before you today. The court clarified what the court wanted to talk about today. Issued an order, and basically said, tell us about two things. Tell us, one, what the scope of our review is for our 2014 decision in light of Hyatt 2. And next, tell us about the application of the statutory caps on the intentional tort claims. Those are the two things the court asked us to really focus on. And I'd like to be able to focus on that today, Your Honor, and honors, and see if I can't answer those questions specifically. What's the scope of your review? The scope of your review is, I think, articulated by the Supreme Court itself in Hyatt 2, very opening paragraph when it addresses the question of the statutory caps. It first says we're going to grant cert on two things. Are we going to reverse the IDU all? Said no, we're equally divided. And then it said now we're going to go into the statutory cap question. And this is what the court said. It's illuminated in terms of what California asked the court to do, and then what your review is going to be on this decision now that it's back from the U.S. Supreme Court. Here's what the court said. Opening paragraph of this question on statutory damages. California also asks us to reverse the Nevada court's damage decision insofar as it awards the private citizen greater damages than Nevada law would permit a private citizen to obtain in a civil suit against Nevada's own agencies. That's what California asked the Supreme Court to do. Take a look at this. Statutory caps apply to Nevada agencies. They ought to apply to us. What did the U.S. Supreme Court say? Quote, we agree that Nevada's application of its damages law in this case reflects a special and constitutionally forbidden policy of hostility to the public acts of a sister state. Close quote. We set aside the Nevada Supreme Court's case, the Nevada Supreme Court's decision accordingly. That's the scope of your review. What was the policy that the U.S. Supreme Court identified as hostile to the public acts of a sister state? One thing and one thing only. The special rule that the court developed on statutory caps. I went through and counted 10 times the U.S. Supreme Court says special rule or special law. That reflects a hostile policy towards the acts of a sister state. There's not a word in this decision that says you've got to go back and look at everything. There's not a word in this decision that says there's a general hostility of this court towards the state.
So, Mr. Hutchison, you're just asking us to look at the mandate from the U.S. Supreme Court, adjust the damages, and we're done? Is that basically it?
Justice Gibbs is exactly right, and I'll go to the last page of my notes to tell you exactly what we're asking for. We want this court to simply reaffirm its 2014 opinion on the merit issues that were resolved and were not addressed by the U.S. Supreme Court. We'd like the court to modify its damage amount on the fraud claim to conform to the statutory amount. On the other intentional infliction of emotional distress, we'd ask the court to affirm its decision on liability, and then to limit the damages to the statutory cap. So reaffirm the liability findings, liability determinations, adjust for the cap, and then determine that there is sufficient evidence in the record to support an award of at least the statutory limit of damages to each of those two claims. You already did that with fraud. You already said there's enough evidence on the $1.1 million jury verdict on fraud. That's easy then. Apply the statutory cap to that one. What about intentional infliction of emotional distress? What we'd like the court to consider, in light of how long this case has gone on, and the length of the delay, and the resources of the parties and the court and everybody else, is to say the record supports at least the statutory cap for the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. And let me tell you where you can find that support in the court's own decision in 2014. The court has already said two things I think that are important in that regard on the intentional infliction of emotional distress damage cap request that we're asking the court to do, to follow. One, the court in this decision in 2014 said this, quote, addressing the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, quote, turning to the facts in this case, Hyatt suffered extreme treatment from the FTB. Close quote. The court also went on to say, much of the evidence presented at trial would not violate the restrictions against considering the audit conclusions. But then it went on to say there was some, and so we're going to vacate the damages award and send it back for a new trial. So what we'd ask the court to do then is determine that there is sufficient evidence in the record to support the award of at least the statutory cap to both the fraud and the intentional infliction claim, vacate the order on new trial for damages, and then just remand for a new determination on cost and interest. That's what we're asking Justice Gibbons that the court do. We think that is the appropriate thing to do. We think the record supports that. And we think that is certainly consistent with what the Supreme Court has said. And that's the mandate that you have to be concerned about, that the appellants continue to support in the Hyatt 2 decision. In the Hyatt 2 decision, there's a mandate that there always is at the very end, the last paragraph. And the appellants really emphasize this language, which is the last sentence of the mandate. Quote, we vacate its judgment and remand the case for further proceedings not inconsistent with this opinion. Close quote. It's the way the court generally sends back a remand to a Supreme Court, as in this case, or to a court of appeals. But what the appellants don't emphasize, and I didn't hear in this argument, you don't see in their brief, is just how narrow this mandate is. I've already quoted to you the narrowness of the mandate. This special rule on damage cap. Special rule on damage cap that exhibits a policy of hostility towards the sister states' public acts. But here is the preceding sentence of that mandate that is not emphasized by the appellants. Quote, for these reasons, again, insofar as the Nevada Supreme Court has declined to apply California law in favor of a special rule of Nevada law that is hostile to its sister state, we find this decision unconstitutional. Didn't address discretionary immunity. As a matter of fact, you may recall in the cert petition, the FTV asked the court specifically to address discretionary immunity. And this court's decision is discretionary immunity. That was denied, not part of the cert review. Court didn't address that in its decision. Court didn't address, the sufficiency of the evidence and the fraud. Didn't support the intentional infliction of emotional stress claims. All the other issues, exhaustion of administrative remedies. All of those issues were not addressed by the...
Mr. Hutchinson, I understand your request for relief in this remand, but a significant part of the 2014 opinion was the court's adoption of a sliding scale approach to proving an IIED claim.
Right.
That was a significant step in, at least in my view, in clarifying the type of evidence that would be considered for such claims. Here you ask us to uphold the IIED claim and ignore the sliding scale approach we enacted in that opinion. What would be the basis for us reconsidering that new rule of law?
Justice Hardesty, I'm not asking you to reconsider that rule of law. I'm just simply asking that you apply it in light of the record. I think that you can see what the record is before the court. It's already, the court has already indicated in the decision that Mr. Hyatt suffered from extreme misconduct by the FTB. The court has also said that there's much evidence that was not tainted by any problems with evidentiary issues or with the jury instructions. And what we're asking the court to do is you've got a jury that found $85 million would be supportive of an emotional distress claim. We're asking the court to find that the record at least provides a minimum the statutory caps. So we're asking the court to, in light of how long this case has gone on, in light of the record before it, and applying the legal principles already set forth by the court in the 2014 decision, that be the result. We understand the court ordered that there be a new trial on those damages, but again, we ask the court's consideration for what I've just requested. Now, if I could turn to the second issue that the court asked us to address, and I've got much more on the scope that I can certainly come back to, but I want to make sure that I get the second point that the court asked us to hit, which is, tell us about the application of the damage cap to the intentional torts. First, the U.S. Supreme Court has said they apply to both the fraud claim as well as the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. This court, in its 2014 opinion, has already said that there are two different awards that will be made under both of those claims. So there are separate caps for each claim. And then the question is the amount. When the case started, no question, back in 1998, it was a $50,000 cap. We alleged that there were ongoing and continuous torts that continued all the way up until the eve of trial, which would be the end of 2007. particularly the bad faith delay and the continuing bad faith of the FDB in delaying these matters. And that takes us at the end of 2007 to the $75,000 cap. Of course, today it's a $100,000 cap. We would ask the court, again, in light of the extent of this case's delay and the length of the case, to apply the upper level of the statutory caps and to exercise the court's discretion in that regard. That would certainly be consistent with Nevada law, and certainly be consistent with what the court could do in this case as well. So that's what we would ask the court at the end of the day to do for this case, and to bring it to a conclusion that it deserves, and a conclusion that is within the mandate that the U.S. Supreme Court has asked the court to focus on. The mandate by the United States Supreme Court is there's a policy that was put in place. You can, the appellants are just wrong. You don't have to treat a sister state exactly the same as you would treat an agency of the state. Hyatt 1 established that. A state can adopt a special rule that discriminates against a sister state if it's sufficient public policy considerations to justify the application of the special rule. And that's where the U.S. Supreme Court just differed with this court. The U.S. Supreme Court said you can do that. He said that the cap doesn't apply to the FPB because there aren't sufficient restraints in place by their regulatory, legislative, and executive branches like there are in Nevada, so we're not going to apply the cap. And the court didn't say that wasn't a policy. The court just said that wasn't a sufficient policy to justify some sort of a different application of the law under the full faith and credit clause. So to continue to insist that the court must treat the FPB the same as they treat any Nevada agency is just not accurate. It's just not the law, it's not what the Supreme Court said. And it isn't what the Supreme Court said for a very long time, including Hyatt 1 and Hyatt 2. The underlying public policy that I'm just going to articulate for the court, that the court is well aware of, is these issues that the appellants raise over and over again have been decided for a very long time. Exhaustions of administrative remedies, we argued that back in 2002, repeatedly, and it was decided as of 2002. Whether or not a fraud claim can be brought against a state agency, whether or not an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim can be brought against a state agency, that's been argued and decided since 2002. There's no reason, and in fact it would be bad public policy, to go back and revisit those issues that were never touched upon or addressed by the U.S. Supreme Court. They would upset policies of finality, predictability, stability, consistency, and fairness. The court previously reviewed lengthy briefing before issuing its 2014 opinion. I think we argued that case twice before the court. There's nothing more that any of us can add. These issues have been briefed and argued ad nauseum. There's no reason to go back and relitigate them all now. There's nothing, not one thing, in Hyatt 2 that requires this court to do this. All that Hyatt 2 requires is the court take a look at the statutory damages cap, the special rule that applied concerning statutory damages, and change that so that it's consistent with the way we treat a Nevada agency. That's the only way in which the court found that there was anything unconstitutional about this court's decision. And there is nothing that's cited in the briefs. There is nothing that you will hear in oral argument that will say that the court required this court to go back and review all of the issues in the case. The court also knows about the points that we have made concerning waiver. The only thing that the appellants argued after the trial in terms of how the district court violated Hyatt 1 was the statutory cap. Said that it violated Hyatt 1 because of the statutory cap application, and it should have been limited to the damages that are found in the statute. It did not argue previously after appeal of the trial that the IAED claims could not be brought against the state agency. Didn't argue that there was no Nevada precedent for fraud claims against Nevada agency. Didn't argue that there was an exhaustion of administrative remedies that should have been followed. As I said, none of those were raised in this appeal, the 2014 decision, and those had all been decided back in 2002. Of course, as far as failing is concerned, the court has discussed that numerous times. It's a workers' compensation claim. It's a workers' compensation case, and it's not a situation where punitive damage is not permitted in an administrative context. It says specifically that they're not permitted in a workers' compensation context. For all these reasons, Your Honor, honors, and as I've articulated, Mr. Hyde appreciates your time, appreciates the efforts of this court, and we stand on the briefing and on the argument. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Richardson.
Ms. Lundvall?
Three points in response, Your Honor. Number one is that Mr. Richardson accurately described the fact that this case was filed in 1998. In 1998, in accord with his Rule 11 obligation, he had to make a representation that that case at that point in time is that liability and damages had been accrued then by his client. And so therefore, the statutory cap of $50,000 that was in place in 1998 under your own authority then should apply.
What about the continuing nature of the tort?
There were allegations, and they made allegations that they continue today. But what was tried was what had accrued as of 1998. And so to the extent, Your Honor, that we believe that there is no exception then to the fact that these actions and the alleged harm then accrued as of 1998. But the more important issue that I want to focus upon is the scope of the review by this court of the United States Supreme Court's decision. What Mr. Hutchison has argued to you, both in the papers and now today, is that the scope of your review is limited by the question that was presented. We brought you numerous authorities in our reply brief to underscore the fact that that is not what the scope of the court's review is. Just last week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral argument in a case involving appointment of an expert or criminal indigent dependent. And the Solicitor General of the state of Alabama had advanced that same argument to the court. And the justices pushed back on that. In fact, Justice Kagan said that looking at the question presented as a determination of what our opinion held would be a shocking way by which to interpret the court's opinions. And so to the extent that we too submit that that would be a shocking way. Now, number three, the point I would like to make is Mr. Hutchison suggests that the court only abandoned the court's special rule that dealt with damages, but the U.S. Supreme Court would find it okay to have a special rule that did not require a clear and convincing review of a fraud claim against the FTP, or that they would find it okay to have a special rule of no allowance of collateral attacks against Nevada agencies, but we are going to allow a collateral attack against the FTP. Or that a special rule that would say parts of the FTP, but not all of the opinion applies to FTP, in contrast to what applies to state agencies.
Did you make those arguments? Did you make those arguments in the appeal?
In the appeal to this court, we did. Yes, we did, Your Honor. And so to the extent that we have raised these issues and we have been rebuffed on these particular points. Now, the last issue that what he wants to do is he wants to continue to advocate that it's okay for the court to have special rules to articulate public policies by which to support those public rules. If you look at the dissenting opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court in the 2016 opinion, Justice Roberts makes clear his interpretation of the majority decision. The majority decision, in speaking about the havoc and the chaos it would create among states if there were any special rules. And Justice Roberts takes that position and says that the majority opinion makes clear that you cannot have special rules or special justifications to try to justify then discriminatory, hostile treatment against the sister state. So in effect, what we have argued to the court is that this court may not discriminate against FTP. It may not show hostility to the FTP. And that hostility is looked at as to whether or not that you abandoned or disregarded your own ordinary legal principles. And if you take off your lens, that you're looking at the California Franchise Tax Board standing before you, and put on a lens that this is Nevada's Department of Taxation, and look at it as a Nevada Department of Taxation case, we submit that the court would use protections of exhaustion of administrative remedies, deference to the fact-finding, and also the immunity statutes that we have brought to the court's attention. And you would dismiss the claims both for fraud and intentional infliction. And through that lens of a Nevada agency standing before you is the same lens that is supposed to be applied to the state of California.
Thank you, Ms. Lundell. The court thanks both Mr. Hutchison and Ms. Lundell for your fine arguments. We expected that from both of you, and you lived up to at least my expectations. This matter will stand submitted.